I suppose, represents the second stage in a discussion of 20th century ideologies is on fascism, Bolshevism, National Socialism, and fascism, all of which are conventionally seen as related ideologies, and all of which are seen as forces which the United States, in some fashion, overcame, usually militarily, in the course of the 20th century. There was a book on multiculturalism, which I was looking at, a book that was intended to be an antidote to multiculturalism by a man named Alvin Schmidt, who suggests that Americans could feel great pride because we have overcome these three hideous ideologies and have made the world safe for democracy in the end. There was also a piece which appeared on January 1st, 2000, in the Wall Street Journal by the eminent neoconservative scholar, you have to pardon the oxymoron, Francis Fukuyama, that, you know, it was a good thing. It was in praise of the United States for winning the First World War on the grounds that had we not, he says, people may deplore the fact that what came after the war were these scoundrels like Hitler and Stalin, but it was all worth it. Because he could simply have argued it was avoidable, which I think he seemed to suggest, if we had done the right things like sit on Europe after the First World War. but all of this was in any case worth it, because the upshot of the war in the end was that we had destroyed the bourgeois civilization of the Western world, which is a good thing from a neoconservative point of view, because the world would have been less egalitarian, less feminist, less open to the sort of yuppie lifestyle that I suppose Mr. Fukuyama leads or would like to imagine that he leads. And we would all be living, and he said, some liberalized version of South Africa. This, I assume, was before Nelson Mandela took over. There would not be a welfare state and all the other good aspects of liberal democracy as he understands it. And up until then, I'd never been aware that the Kaiser was fighting for all these good ideals. apparently he was, you know, at least according to Fukuyama. But there is no question that the First World War is in many ways a kind of turning point, because the disruptions of the war, the wartime economy, and the mobilization that the war brings, and finally the frustrations caused by the subsequent peace treaty, will feed into the mass movements of the interwar years, of which there are, you know, three major ones: fascism, communism, and National Socialism. If one were looking at the world perhaps in the 1920s, it would seem that the most successful of the three was fascism. My friend Jean Lukács, you know, always tells me that, Mussolini was serious, Lenin was a joke. I think by which he means that Mussolini appealed to something real, nationalism. You know, people feel this in their gut, whereas Marxist Leninism is sort of based on an abstract, universalist ideal that outside of intellectuals most people don't believe in, and if some people will fight for it, it's because they're hungry and want food or want redistribution of land. whatever the case, I think in the 1920s fascism was looked upon as the wave of the future, the paradigm for a managerial society. And another thing that sort of comes out of the early 20th century and the growth of mass industrial societies is the notion of government planning. And the Italian model is seen as one that was working in the 1920s, largely because of puffery and public relations and so forth. but it also seemed to be able to combine ideas that seemed to belong to the 20th century, both nationalism and socialism. But what's very important about the socialism was fairly ambiguous. It talked about collectivism. It talked about the Stato totalitario. There was a totalitarian state. But actually, the state was not all that total. There was a very, very large, you know, free economy that continues to exist in Italy throughout the 1920s, into the 1930s, which, by the way, was generally not criticized by progressive social democrats and others who did look upon Mussolini's reform, his Rivoluzione Nazionale, as a serious, you know, attempt to create within nations, particular nations, a kind of model of social planning, government social planning that could be exported under the proper conditions to the United States and to England and to other countries. It is really not, I would say, until the rise of Nazism and the alliance of Mussolini with Hitler that fascism is perceived as a wicked right-wing ideology. There's a very good book by John Patrick Diggins on fascism as seen from the United States, in which he, you know, goes through issues of the New Republic, and just about everybody there, including John Dewey, was very impressed by Mussolini, and saw in him a kind of an architect of the kind of social planning they were trying to introduce. In fact, Dewey wished to use the word corporatism to describe what he was doing until Mussolini sort of fell from grace, at which point he very successfully chose the term liberalism to describe what clearly was anti-liberal, but that term has been able to stick. But in any case, I think fascism of the 20s is seen as a much more successful model than Bolshevism. The Bolsheviks are sort of fumbling around. There are various attempts to take governments over by force in England, France, and other places, all of which will be very quickly discovered and derailed. The Russian government is struggling. It does make an alliance with the Germans in the 1920s. Actually, the German right wants the alliance. They can train German troops in Russia. But this really does not really help the. This does not help the Russians very much, or the Soviet government in terms of Western influence. The Communist Party in the United States is pretty much of a joke. It splits. It means constantly fragments, particularly after the rise of Stalin. So if one were to choose, and then of course there is an attempted communist takeover of China in the 1920s, which fails miserably. other attempts fail miserably in Hungary, in Germany, and elsewhere. So the Finland. So the Soviets do not seem to be in a particularly strong position, whereas Mussolini is a man of honor. Fascists are sent, there's Chicago, an aviator, Balbo, comes here, and they put up in fact, it still stands in Buckingham Park in Chicago, and this is put in the second year of the Italian National Revolution, you know, and he was greatly honored. I mean, this Italian aviator was, you know, we were mobbing him, pelting him with flowers and confetti and so forth. So the 1920s were very much, I think, a period in which the fascists seemed to be the successful managerial model. Okay, in the 1930s, you have the rise of Nazism in Germany. I really do not want to get into a discussion of, you know, is Nazism fascist? Is Nazism Stalinist? It is, in fact, a combination. The Germans pick from various managerial models, but the result is infinitely more demonic and sinister than what happens in Italy, although not more sinister or demonic than what happens in Russia under Stalin. It just gets a worse press because it lands up on the losing side of the Second World War. But the German Nazis are also going to enjoy a certain success for a while, despite the bad public relations caused by their anti-Semitism, which is not well received in the United States. I mean, Nazi Germany is hated. I mean, contrary to what Jewish groups say, that everybody loved Hitler, and this is not true. I mean, the Nazis were hated in England and other countries, particularly because of their anti-Semitism, which was very blatant. And you see, the humiliation of Jews in these films and so forth, which were circulated, and these were not well received in Western countries. And for a while, they even, you know, created a reaction in fascist Italy from Mussolini. So that this was the dark side of the Nazis. But they did use the language of peace, you know, and to quote Ralph's expression, they wish to serve mankind. And it's incredible how many of Hitler's speech, you know, contains the word Friede or Frieden. We're doing this for peace. Whatever they're doing is always for peace. We want to put this dispute out of the way or something. And then we can all have peace. So he does use this language of peace, but the behavior toward Jews and toward other groups that are sort of singled out for special treatment is so unpleasant and also so widely known that the Nazis will not receive as good a press, certainly, as the Italian fascists had before. Nonetheless, I think John Lukács, who writes about this period, is correct, that in the 1930s it does appear that Hitler has become sort of the leading fascist, and many people admire him and see him as a great National Socialist leader who has, in a sense, sort of taken over and perfected the Italian fascist paradigm. There also, as the historian, I think, Ernst Nolte, the German historian, quite rightly points out, a kind of competition that goes on between a Nazi fascist and a Bolshevik model in the 1930s, in which people who are strongly anti-communist in Central Europe feel, in some cases, driven to support the German, because of the German-Italian side, rather than the Soviet side. They see this, or the communist side. And the communists, I think, are quite rightly seen throughout the 30s as the more dangerous mass murderers. I mean, they've already carried out the things that Hitler will be doing in the succeeding decade. And they're also aiming their destructive energies against the middle class. They're anti-bourgeois. So that the much of the middle class sort of feels a... according to Nolte, and I think this is partly true. It depends on the area. They feel that somehow the German-Italian connection or ideological camp is safer than the communist camp. And they sort of, one might say, emotionally or in terms of disposition, drift in that direction. Nonetheless, the communists are going to start to make a comeback in the Soviets in the 1930s. Despite the fact that they're, you know, wildly massacring people in the Ukraine and then during the purge trials and so forth, because at this time Stalin is following, at least in terms of his relations with the Western countries, the Popular Front tactic, by which he calls, through his foreign minister Litinov, calls upon all of the Western progressive parties to join with the communist parties in a front against the fascist menace. This, in a sense, sort of improves the stock of the communists. The communists also are able to make gains during the Depression. They certainly make them in Germany, where they helped to bring down the Weimar Republic, together with the Nazis. The communist role is probably as significant. And the communists also play roles in disrupting the French government in the 1930s, together with parties of the nationalist right. And the communist membership in the United States will go up. I mean, the communists do manage to pull, I think, 1 million votes at one point in the American election. They become very substantial. But the problem is that they break apart because they're fragmented in the United States between the followers of Trotsky, the followers of Stalin, other sort of communist sectarians like the Lovestonites, out of which some of the neoconservatives, by the way, come. They're Lovestonites. They're not really Trotskyists. but you have all these sort of breakaway, fragmented communist movements, some of them, in fact, dislike the Soviets more than they dislike the Nazis. So, but nonetheless, I think one would have to say in the 1930s, the communists do become a major force, or viewed as a major force of resistance against both the Nazis and to some extent the fascists. They always use the word fascism to refer to all their enemies on the right, are all fascists, including the Social Democrats. They call them fascists. But I mean, that's sort of the anti-fascist alliance which they provide. And they also are able to project themselves successfully in European countries as a workers' party which will redistribute the fruits of production and overcome what seem to be the inequities and irregularities or disruptions of the capitalist system. So the 1930s, the communists do make a comeback, and there is no question that if you look at the end of the Second World War, the communists are big winners. They're big winners despite the fact that they had been treacherous. They had supported the Nazis. Something that is hardly ever mentioned. I mean, I never hear this mentioned. It's not even mentioned. One never dares mention this, even in France. I mean, if you say this, you know, this is considered to be a fascist statement. But in France, they went so far in observing the Nazi-Soviet pact when Hitler and Stalin were allies that they, A, undermined the war effort of the French, B, beat up, killed members of the Communist Party who fought against Hitler. And it was only when the Soviet Union is invaded that the Communist Party in France, Italy, and other countries will turn around. You see? But by the end of the war, they not only, you know, bear the mantle of anti-fascism and the resistance, but they carry out savage reprisals against people who are far less guilty of collaboration than they were. And they do this in Italy and in France and other countries. the communists are also are able, like in a country like Yugoslavia, to wipe out monarchist opponents of the Nazis who had resisted them, the Nazis, and then to depict them as fascist collaborators. This is always the communists. They're very successful. They still do this sort of thing. It still goes on. It goes on forever. It will never end. The left always depicts everybody they fight against as a fascist. Even if these people are 100% anti-Nazis, they were fascists. And this will go on at the end of the war. But in the end of the war, it exacts savage reprisals. There is a book in French published in the 60s by a man named Paul Serrand called Les Vaincus et la Libération, The Vanquished and the Liberation, which gives very detailed figures. And you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who disappear. And in Italy, Marco Bassani, it was hundreds of thousands that were wiped out there too. And a lot of it was just a matter of just taking revenge on somebody you didn't like. But the Communist Party somehow comes out of the war smelling good. They had won. And of course, they had been the worst collaborators. They turned around and they're exterminating other people at the end of the war. And they weren't even the best resistance force in these countries during the war. They were not. This is a lie. But what they do is they take control of the left and of the so-called anti-fascist side and come out on top at the end of the war. The communists will continue to ride high for a while, though by the 1950s, I think there's a very definite reaction in the other direction in most European countries. I think there's a kind of movement back toward the right, which starts to take place. You have, you know, sort of conservative Christian Democrat governments. We even have neo-fascist parties winning elections or winning local elections, but being able to reorganize themselves in some countries. And the communists are generally in very bad odor throughout the Western world. I mean, they're seen as repressive. They're associated with Stalinism and so forth. And at this point, there develops a theory which I think might be, you know, re-examined today, because it's one that I know that I grew up with. And I believed until relatively recently, and this is the view that communism, Nazism, all these things are totalitarian movements, and that they're all pretty much the same. The struggle against Nazism leads into the struggle against the second kind of Nazism, which is Soviet Bolshevism. And that we're somehow the good guys because we land up, you know, destroying all these monsters in the end, or at least opposing all these monsters in the end. And the theory of totalitarianism, which is originally, a number of people put it together. There's actually a deviationist Marxist named Franz Borkenau in the 1930s who comes up with this theory. Karl Wittfogel, I knew, you know, had created such a theory by the 1940s. But it's a famous book by Brzezinski and Karl Friedrich, Zbigniew Brzezinski and Karl Friedrich, on totalitarianism, that comes out soon after the Second World War, in which this argument is put forth that totalitarian governments are qualitatively different from both democratic and authoritarian ones, because totalitarian governments control everything in the societies that they take over and use terror as a way of enforcing control, distort reality by creating some sort of ideology that is empirical nonsense, but which they force upon people as an instrument of control. Authoritarian governments are seen simply as undeveloped regimes that exist, or primitive regimes that exist in economically primitive parts of the world. Parts of the world that have not yet modernized, because once they modernize, you'll get middle classes forming together with a strong drive toward the creation of parliamentary democratic institutions. Therefore, Spain has an authoritarian government because it's you know, sort of economically primitive and agrarian under Franco. As it becomes urbanized, it will move into the good democratic camp. Whereas totalitarian governments are sort of dead end. I mean, they can't go anywhere. They have to be removed, usually by force, because their control is total and they're incapable of evolving, since they totally destroy anything that stands in their way. This argument is presented in a kind of turgid Germanic fashion by Hannah Arendt in what I think is one of the worst written books of all times, Origins of Totalitarianism. It's a kind of book that's sort of like a garbage can, which you throw every idea that ever occurred to this this dotty German refugee. But part of her argument is to show that Hitler and Stalin really have sort of similar roots, and that Stalinism and Nazism are pretty much the same, but one's a continuation of the other. Now, I think if we hear these sorts of arguments, there's nothing intrinsically offensive or would seem unreasonable about them, right? When we talk about right and left, we really don't mean, you know, Hitler on one side and Stalin on the other side. Or if there is a political spectrum in which these people, you know, stand on one side or the other, it is different from any political spectrum we'd want to be a part of, right? And we can generally agree on this. The question in my mind is that why was this model of totalitarianism never really widely accepted, except as a military propagandistic tool in pursuing the Cold War? I mean, most intellectuals do not seem to buy into this. That is because most intellectuals like the communist and do not want to compare them in any way to Hitler or even to Mussolini, right? And I remember, even as a young assistant professor at Case Western Reserve many decades ago, people would never refer to communism, it would be Stalinism. And Stalinism was never as bad as fascism. Although Mussolini only killed about 10 people and Stalin killed about 50 million, you don't want to compare these two. You know, so there was always this favorable comparison of Stalinism to Italian fascism, or certainly to Franco, who was, you know, even worse than Hitler. But the fact is, most intellectuals did not buy this because they thought that communism and the kind of manipulative socialism they believed in were really the same. There was, like, no reason to make these distinctions, you know. on the other hand, I think they probably believed that Richard Nixon was at least as bad as Hitler or something like this. McCarthy, I mean, you see this on CNN. I mean, McCarthy was worse than Stalin. he had the whole country gripped with fear and so forth. So, I mean, the intellectuals were actually very soft on the communists. They thought Stalin maybe went a little bit too far, but they would vote for one of his henchmen anyhow. But I mean, the totalitarian argument was never really bought. I would make this because I was strongly anti-communist and thought that the communists were, in fact, the worst mass murderers of all times and were being defended by everybody, you know, in the name of fighting some long-dead fascist enemy and so forth. This, of course, goes on even now. But the totalitarian model, I think, is flawed from the very outset, and I'll try to explain why. Not every totalitarian government has acted in the way that totalitarian governments are supposed to act. For instance, the Soviet Union did not fall apart because it got invaded. I mean, you're told by Hannah Arendt, by Brezhnev, that it's going to fall apart because these countries are going to be torn down, or there'll be a violent overthrow of the government. The Soviet Union did not go away that way. What you had was it became better by stages from what it had been under Stalin, and finally, you know, just sort of imploded from within when it sort of overextended itself. The Chinese government, which was, you know, quite totalitarian, in our sense, has in fact become a lot better than it was under Mao. I mean, it may not be, you know, an ideal state into which we'd want to live and so forth, but, you know, is it totalitarian? It's also questionable in my mind whether Maoist China really had control over, or the government really had control over everybody. You're dealing with a country of over a billion people who are dispersed over a very, very large landmass. I have a young colleague who's Chinese who's doing a book on Chinese politics, in which she's certainly not a Marxist, and she's arguing that there's very little control over the central government. There is central government, very little control over the people. They collect very few taxes. They can't. The economic system is so inefficient in the country. And you go on and on like this. So, I mean, countries that we consider totalitarian, maybe brutal, unpleasant, you wouldn't want to live there, but do they necessarily follow the totalitarian model? And my answer is no. They all have to be overthrown from within in order to be gotten rid of. What I would argue in the end is that the whole model of totalitarianism, and I think Ralph Rako and I were discussing this, and Ralph may want to ask me a pointed, embarrassing question or two at the end. I think that one problem with the totalitarian model is it basically is an attempt created by the social democratic left to project onto communism what is a kind of fascist Nazi bugaboo. And again, with John Lukács, you know, made the argument that Hannah Arendt was essentially a Trotskyist, and that the origins of totalitarianism is a Trotskyist view of both, you know, Germany and the Soviet Union. You know, that it is somehow a derailed form of socialism that has, you know, resulted in this monstrous kind of regime. But what makes the Soviet Union bad is it resembles a fascist state. So that one might say the paradigm of ultimate evil in the totalitarian conception is always something like Nazism. It is not the Soviets. The Soviets are bad because they're red fascists, to use, you know, Harry Truman's term. It is not that the Nazis are imitating the communists, which may be historically true. I think Nolte is correct. You know, I mean, the model that Hitler gave was Stalin's model. It was there. No, it is that the Soviets evolve into something like what the Germans or other evil fascist countries were in the 1930s, and therefore can only be dealt with the way Nazi Germany was by decimating, going in there, taking over the country, and so forth. So it is, not all of them, of course, go quite that far. They usually are never as angry at the Soviets as they are as the Germans. But they don't want to invade them, bomb them, you know, carry out saturation bombing of Russians. So you don't get this sort of, well, you know, it's not possible anymore. But actually, the dislike of the Soviets, usually among the advocates of totalitarian theory, was never as strong as the dislike of the Nazis. I think what you typically get is an attempt to sort of push on to the Soviets or the Chinese what are the features of the Nazi German government. One of the interesting cases of this is 1984 by George Orwell, who is seen in many ways as the person who takes the managerial models of James Burnham. He was influenced by Burnham, this is the managerial revolution, and takes this model and then uses it to create this hellish dystopic society, you know, in which various regions are killing each other and so forth. And supposedly this is an anti-Stalinist book. Well, I've read it, and it looks like an anti-Nazi book to me. I mean, they're militaristic. I mean, you do have some Stalinist stuff there, like the war against Trotsky, who becomes Goldstein in 1984. But it's a perpetually belligerent society, always engaged in war against other regions and mobilizing for war. And, you know, you can't help feeling and looking at this is that what he's describing is, you know, the fascist glorification of war, which he then transfers onto the communists. If you read Orwell, he always says this, that the communists look like Nazis. I mean, this is something he says in his correspondence. I would finally say that all of this sort of leads to a kind of misunderstanding, and this is a problem which my friend Hans Hermann Hoppe had a few years ago when he suggested in some article that Nazi Germany was not as totalitarian as the Soviet Union under Stalin. And this was considered to be the worst sort of lèse majesté or just crime against humanity or against the nobility of the human soul and so forth. And he was actually, his article, I think, was banned from some libertarian journal, and they hanged him in effigy and so forth. Now, what he said is perfectly true. I mean, it's like, you know, self-evident that, I mean, the Nazis may have been very unpleasant. They, you know, they incarcerated members of my family. They probably killed others. I mean, I have no, you know, brief for them. But they did not have the kind of control of opinion that the media and the state have in the United States today. I mean, or in Germany today. I mean, Germany is a hellhole of intellectual totalitarianism today, even in comparison to Hitler. I mean, Hitler killed a lot more people. He put them in concentration camps. They got brutalized, everything else. He was a gangster. He was a mass murderer. But if you're talking about totalitarianism, you have to also talk about control of thought. This is basic to totalitarianism. And the Nazis did not control thought in the same manner that the communists did. You know? Nonetheless, I would say the communist states did fall apart. They disintegrated at a certain point. They all fell apart. You didn't have to invade them, any of these things. They fell apart. Even though they were more totalitarian. The left is always more totalitarian in this regard, in the sense that they try to control people's thought, reconstruct their consciousness much more intensively and much more relentlessly than any right-wing government or even a brutal, you know, ultra-nationalist gangster like Hitler. There's just no comparison. This is the way the left operates. And I don't think the totalitarian model really takes that into account, that these are different types of control. You know, that the Nazis committed mass murder, brutalized people, invaded countries all over the place, carried out an insane foreign policy, everything else. But they did not engage in the same degree of thought control as the communists in most countries did. However, even the communists will change. I mean, if you look at communist Hungary 20 years ago, there was less thought control there than you get in your Western European countries of today, which nonetheless have relatively freer market economies. Okay, I'm not going to, you know, it's nothing to write home about. They're heavily socialized economies, but there's more of a free market in Germany today than there was in Hungary 20 years ago, but I would say there's far more thought control. Imprisonment for disagreeing with political correctness, criminalization of everything else, but there's more of a market economy. again, this does not fit the totalitarian model, which I think is really a kind of Cold War liberal relic in the end. I mean, it doesn't really work to explain all these variations. And the fact that not all totalitarian governments behave the same way, supposedly totalitarian governments, and some are able to change from within. I mean, it's quite possible that the Soviets could change from within. The Nazis might not have been able to do this. They might have become worse and worse. but, you know, did the Nazi model necessarily apply to the Soviet Union? Were the Nazis as intellectually totalitarian as the Soviets? No, they were not. But on the other hand, there may have been other aspects of their government that were more dangerous. But, you know, I think one has to look at individual political models, even of the most disagreeable governments, without making these judgments. Was Mussolini's Italy a totalitarian state? Well, as much as Mussolini liked the term totalitarian, the answer is no. It was a rather weak state. Everybody marched around with a uniform or something or sang a song, but it had, you know, it had a relatively free economy. In comparison to the United States today, it did not engage in a particularly adventurous foreign policy. They bombed Corfu. They tried to grab Albania, you know. Should have, you know, handed it to them, just take it, you know, no complaints. But, you know, I mean, they did not try to serve mankind the way we do it today. So they didn't have the means to do it. I mean, they were too weak a state. But I think it was, I generally agreed at a certain point that Italy was not totalitarian, just bad or something like that. Was Franco-Spain totalitarian? Because very often the term did get used. The answer is no. You know, it was a kind of traditional military dictatorship. So then it fell into the authoritarian camp. The argument about authoritarian governments I find much more convincing than totalitarian ones. That there are governments which do not develop into, one might say, full-fledged middle-class societies, which are sort of socioeconomically more in the past, which are usually highly agrarian, and there are certain types of political social crises that occur, which favor a one-party government under a strong leader, and those are usually affairs of time. They usually get blown away or they change into something else. So I think what one can agree about the authoritarian government without necessarily assuming the judgments that are associated with the totalitarian model, which I think becomes more and more open to question. And I think, as I said, more and more associated with a certain kind of Cold War liberal politics. I hope I've given you enough food for thought, since I've said much that will cause controversy, or at least cause you to think about the problems that I've raised. Perhaps I can now open this to questions.
Yes, sir. You mentioned that there's a lot of imprisonment, or there is imprisonment for PC in Germany. Mm-hmm. Can you give me a few examples, please?
Well, there actually was a piece in the New York Times about a year and a half ago. I try to document this in the book of mine that's now coming out. But you know, people are in jail or are facing criminal charges. I mean, sometimes these things get appealed and they get put in jail. You're able to appeal the case, but they have been accused and found guilty of saying things which threaten the German Constitution or threaten German democracy. I mean, you have agencies that are attached both to the federal and provincial governments which look into these things. There is one case that I looked at which was particularly ominous. It was a German newspaper, which I find very boring, actually, Junge Freiheit, which is supposed to sort of right center. It is, it's probably where the National Review was about 5-10 years ago. It is not as far to the right as, you know, I believe before I subscribe. And they generally support Stoibel, who is the head of the Christian Social Party in Bavaria, who was somewhat critical of immigration. They have been put on a list, a kind of index, in the territory of the land of Nordrhein-Westfalen for about 6 or 7 years now, and also in some of the other lenders. And there's nothing that they do not threaten the democracy, but they're accused of allowing articles that represent a national conservative tendency. Well, in the meantime, they've had to pay for legal costs because they tried to close down their magazine. They've lost their subscribers. They've lost their advertisers. And a Berlin bank closed their account because they don't want to be associated with these politically incorrect people. Now, this kind of thing goes on all the time in Germany. And they're lucky they haven't been thrown in jail because their magazine represents supposed to be a national conservative direction. They've published people critical of third world immigration. And in France, this is a very common occurrence. There was somebody given, I think, 6 months in jail. I don't know if he spent the whole time or whether it was just parole or whatever, for writing an article against immigration, which I looked at, which was, I mean, this, you know, also Holocaust denial in the case of France means denying anything the Nuremberg Tribunal said at the end of the war, so that people have actually been prosecuted for saying that the 10,000 Polish soldiers who were killed in the Katyn Woods were killed by the Soviets and not by the Germans. That is a criminal offense today in France. Okay? And usually you have the Communist Party pushing all this stuff. But the socialists go along with it. They're quite happy to do this.
France, I didn't see any of this in Germany when I was living there.
When were you in Germany?
10 years ago.
Yeah. It actually has become very bad in the last, the last 4 or 5 years. My son studied at Marburg and said he didn't see this, but the point is that you're not writing articles in German. You know, you're not trying to make your living as a German publicist. You're not connected to a German university. You're just living there. You don't necessarily see this. But there are also things like riots that take place in which you have anti-fascist riots. Businesses are destroyed. It sort of like recalls the darkest days of the Nazi takeover, and the police just stand there. They don't even want to get involved. I can give you a lot. There are a lot of books that have come out on this, but there was a speech by a man named Martin Walzel about it. I think Ralph Rather sent this to me about a year ago, or mentioned this to me, and he was given an award for a literary prize, and he said, it's high time we talk about the totalitarian aspect of our government. We seem to be proud of this, and this compulsory guilt about things that most of us never did, and the way this is used to destroy intellectual freedom and freedom of speech and criminalizing improper opinions and so forth. Yes?
Popular discussion nowadays is the current state of the Chinese government. Would you call it authoritarian, totalitarian, or neither?
I would call it an extremely inefficient authoritarian government. Extremely inefficient. I don't even like to use the word totalitarian, though. I'm pretty. I suppose it might apply in some ways to the Soviet and Nazi states. It may have applied to some extent in Maoist China. But the Chinese are a problem. The government is a problem since it's a weak government. It does things that are not nice. But then so did so did governments 500-600 years ago in Europe. But they were not particularly strong governments. They might have grabbed some peasant and hanged him, but their reach didn't extend very much beyond that peasant. So it is not a powerful government like the American government. I mean, American government in terms of technology, in terms of money, anything you want, the media, will justify just about anything the government does as long as the media likes it.
So a distinction for you between authoritarian and totalitarian would be the strength of the state.
Yeah. The authoritarian governments tend to be very weak governments. And we can pick on them because they don't introduce social democratic reforms or do what the American media want. But they're also they're governments that usually disappear at a certain point. They just are replaced by other governments. They just go into retirement. Yes?
I was thinking that I have two comments. One was that I think that sometimes thought control is attributed to Germany more than was really corrected as an excuse for the complacency of the German Mm-hmm. So people think, well, there was all kinds of PR and all kinds of mass thought control. And my other comment was that one thing that seems contrary to your statement about Hitler not being very popular, mm-hmm. or maybe Hitler was popular but the Nazis weren't, what about the thing about him being Times Man of the Year? Twice, I think.
Okay, by the way, being Times Man of the Year, it was explained at the time that this was not a popular, they didn't think he was a nice man. They just thought he had influenced world events.
I see.
I mean, and they made that distinction. Ralph can probably speak on that more because he's done work on this period. But I think that's very clear. I think obviously there was attempt to control. I mean, they pushed anti-Semitism 24 hours a day in Nazi Germany. Obviously people were influenced by this. It was perhaps the most liberal country in terms of treating Jews anywhere in Europe, and suddenly they become handing in Jews and doing this. So obviously this does influence countries. I don't accept for a moment the Goldhagen thesis about every German wanting to kill Jews by 1900. I think this is highly improbable, and the book is a piece of junk, which makes up its quotations and its phony statistics and so forth. But obviously, this is effective propaganda. On the other hand, I think that they say, well, a lot of the Germans weren't complacent. I mean, many of them were afraid of the government. If you disagreed, you'd be in a concentration camp, you'd be beaten up. something like that. I mean, it's not that you just would not be invited to a cocktail party. You know, you'd end up in Dachau. So, you know, there were reasons to go along with the system. Ralph, you? There's nothing I disagree with. Is there anybody else who... Any other questions? Yes, Dan. We'll call on Dan first. This was the kind of stuff, I was telling this to Ralph, this is the kind of stuff that I used to thrill to, I would vibrate to as a young man, because, you know, we're really going to trample on the American Civil Liberties Union. All these liberals who believe in relativism and saying, you know, whatever you want, well, this was entirely untrue. As you see, the left does not believe in saying what you want at all. Now that they've taken over, you know, it's like you have the intellectual freedom of Auschwitz or something. So, I mean, you know, this is all nonsense. I mean, but so the fact is that a lot of that stuff was being turned not only against the left, but I think, as Ralph and Lou and others have pointed out, it was basically being turned against the right as well. Anyone that did not agree with them, you know, got extracized, excommunicated, and so forth. So I think that was a very bad tendency to achieve what the Germans call Gleichschaltung, just sort of force everybody, you know, into the same model of thought, which Buckley began in the 50s. Lou?
Oh, I was just going to mention, too, that Buckley's evil book, God and Man, and Yale.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. And so he's really the godfather of all of this yes. today of purging people who are insensitive right. and don't want diversity. Buckley is responsible for many evils, but this is one of his babies.
Yeah, I read, you know, Got Him at Yale many times, and it was not until I did the second edition of the conservative movement that I began noticing statements that, you know, if you don't believe in democracy, you should be kicked out. And this, it sounds exactly like, you know, Commentary magazine. And you wouldn't have to move very, very far to meet those people there, because you get those arguments, which were even then being, I think, presented by Straussians and others, which he was reprising. I think Ralph also mentioned Sidney Hook, about, you know, we're not going to allow people heresy, yes, but treason, no. And I said, this is really good, you know, first of all, this is like in the early 70s. I said, you know, this man is, you know, he's really onto something. He's really a tough fellow, you know. And little did I know he's going to be turned against the right, you know. But you know, the same thing takes place in Germany which I discovered from doing this work, that you have all these agencies that are created right after the war, like the I don't know what it's called, the Schutzverfassungsstelle or something. Or Schutzverfassungsgericht, the court that tries people for to protect the Constitution. And then there was another one that censored books for children. And the sort of conservative, peck-sniff sort of Christian Democrats, on the right wing, this is fine, we're going to have good Christian morality. You know, they're going to keep communists out. Well, little do they know, you know. In fact, if you go back, there was like in the early 70s, you have some of these Germans like Günter Rohrmoser and others who are talking about how we have to preserve this Christian state against the left, and therefore we have to throw people out of jobs. And this, well, all of his friends got thrown out of jobs as soon as Willy Brandt and these people took over. And they've been turned against the right ever since. You know, I mean, so, but I mean, the right must have been very cocky to believe that they'd get away with this stuff, you know. If you just look at the political forces that were present, you know, it would not be long before you'd be on the receiving end. And I think this happens in a number of Western countries. Yeah.
Were these agencies, in fact, set up by the U.S. government?
Excuse me?
These German agencies were set up by the U.S. government.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I can't think that they were intended ever to be good in a Christian sense or whatever.
Right. Yeah, no, I think what happens is that the Cold War turns things around, because the people who take over in Germany after the war with this Umerziehungsversuch, the attempt to sort of re-educate everybody to believe in global, and you send all these lefty maniacs there like Herbert Marcuse and others, they're just like all, I mean, not only do they bomb the German cities, they unload these crazies on them after, you know, even worse. But what happens is you get into the Cold War. We're fighting the commies, right? So we can't have this because we're having these communists re-educating them. So you have to pull this all back. And, you know, and it's interesting that, you know, the American government in 47 was supporting a socialist neutralist, Schumacher, against Adenauer, who was, you know, pro-Western, anti-communist Catholic. And even under Truman you have this. But then we sort of change course, you know, under Eisenhower and this. And the Germans become the bulwark of Western civilization. And the right pretty much gets to run things, you know, and they are concerned with Christian morality and so forth. And then in the late 60s, as things are turning around in the United States, they turn around in Germany even more drastically under Brandt. And ever since, of course, it is the re-education, which the Germans are doing themselves without American encouragement at this point. Any other question? Yes.
Do you find, you know, totalitarian features in the regimes of Lincoln, Wilson, and FDR to say that these regimes were totalitarian in your definition?
Excuse me, go.
Can we find, you know, totalitarian features in the regimes of Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson, and FDR to say, according to your definition, that these regimes were totalitarian?
Well, I basically like to avoid the term totalitarian. I think what you get in the 20th century are different variations on a managerial regime, because you're dealing with sort of mass industrial societies, all of which appeal to some notion of democracy. And they're all post-liberal. They're become increasingly post-bourgeois societies. And you get, you know, the fascists, I think, are the Italian fascists may be the most conservative, because there's a very large middle-class component. They make an alliance with the Catholic Church in 29 and so forth. The American New Deal is the most successful model, which is a variation on the Scandinavian socialist model, which had already been developed in the 1920s in Sweden, and which, of course, was being planned by English socialists. And that is the one that sort of takes off. The Nazis go nowhere, and the communists fall apart. The point is, does the managerial model, which is created in the United States by the progressives, Wilson, the New Deal, and then, you know, grows in a kind of intermittent fashion, but with ever more vigor in the last third of the 20th century, does that model necessarily lead to total control? And my argument is, yes, it does. Or should we say that there are forces which, within that model, which do this. One thing, it leaves the state in such control that, you know, that it can do all sorts of things to society. It's not that, you know, the state is simply serving us or it's doing a few little things for us or helping us with our retirement plans or something. No. I mean, it tells you what you can say to other people, what's politically correct, women's rights in relation to men. It has recolonized the family. And I think all of these things are, should we say, ever-present dangers which become more and more likely realities once you've created that managerial state. Without the managerial state, you couldn't do these things. You're like, someone would say, well, wouldn't you have a feminist movement without the managerial state? Yes, you would, but it wouldn't amount to a hill of beans. Right? I mean, you need the state to do these things. It's just like you could have had anti-Semitism in Germany in 1931. Would you have had all these millions of Jews killed, you know, without the Nazi state? And the answer is no. You know, you obviously need a political instrument to bring these things about. And the political instrument is so powerful in the case of the United States, and the people are so passive, and the media is so effective in organizing support of the government, so are the churches, unfortunately, that it seems to me that that once you've created this managerial model, the rest is very likely to follow. And you can say, well, why doesn't the managerial model wander off to the right? So it becomes like a kind of traditional Catholic social state that provides, you know, family relief. Well, things don't work this way. That the managerial model that was created in the 1930s was created on the left. And it was a result of social planning. And it always had a certain component of social engineers. And it continues to move in. And the people who go into government service believe all these things. You know, they don't believe in medieval corporatism. They believe in modern social democracy. So I think that once you have created this kind of state, it will inevitably move toward this very despotic leftist social control, as seems to be the case in every Western country.
Do you see all these, one of the things, and I just keep abreast of it like everybody else in the newspaper, but one of the things that strikes me always when I listen to these news clips about these Russians who have all this great new wealth and all the, they have control over these, what used to be state companies and state resources and all this other stuff. Is this fitting into what you're talking about, that Russia is not really disintegrating, it's just molting into...
No, it's disintegrating. It's just the communist leaders have all the money.
That's what I mean.
They basically...
Is the model going to change from what it used to be?
I don't know. Well,
it's something that's still totalitarian, but, you know, they take great wealth from it themselves personally.
Well, no, it's just a kind of it's a kind of kleptocracy today without any kind of ideological foundation. Before, it had some sort of ideological foundation.
In arguing with a liberal friend who's a German lady and telling her, trying to draw the disaster that our socialist thing has done in our families, our cities, our crime, etc., she said, "Well, it hasn't happened in Germany. Why has not it had the catastrophic effect on the social life in Europe?"
Okay, this will be the last question. I think that crime is going up all over Europe. Violent crime in England today is almost comparable to what it is in the United States. And a lot of it is a result of immigration, third world immigration, West Indian immigration. Turks, in fact, do have a higher crime rate than Germans in Germany. And I also think that as the family breaks down and as all the social problems which inevitably accompany socialism and social engineering have their effect, that crime will continue to be on the rise in Europe. I mean, it is more and more the kind of problem that we see in the United States. Okay, well, that's it.